Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is Monday, December the 10th, 2018. I'm actually coming to you today from Atlanta, which is meaningless to you, but if it sounds a little different, it's because our setup today is a little bit different. So thank you for being with us here on Connecting Faith. So the headlines are screaming at us this morning of all kinds of controversy and disconnect that Christians are experiencing in the culture. And so I just wanted to lift up one story here at the outset. And that is about our Heisman Trophy winner, Kyler Murray. Hours after winning the Heisman Trophy, the Oklahoma quarterback, Kyler Murray, had to apologize. And he had to apologize for what are described as anti-gay tweets that he made as a teenager. Now, we're talking about something that happened when he was 14 or 15 years old. And Kyler has now said, you know, those tweets don't reflect who I am, nor do they reflect what I believe. So I want to pause here and note a couple of things for us. And then because I do think that this is a conversation that you and I can engage in with people in the culture at large. We can do so in ways that honor Jesus, but we can also do so in ways that acknowledge that people do change and our views change. And to shame someone for something that they did as a teenager, that's just dangerous territory for us to be moving into in terms of the culture writ large. I don't know about you. I may have done some things when I was a teenager that I would prefer not be publicly remembered today. But like Kyler Murray, I am not the person who I was when I was 14 or 15 years old. Like, we acknowledge that people grow. We acknowledge that that those of us who are Christians, we certainly acknowledge that there's a transformation that takes place over time. By one degree of glory for it to another, we are actually transformed people. And so we can talk about sin, and we can talk about the way that sin is paid for, and we can talk about the need to apologize to those who have been hurt by the things that we have said or done. Kyler has done all of that, and yet still being publicly shamed for what are, you know, I would say insensitive might be the right term, you know, insensitive comments made by a then 14 or 15 year old young man. But his statement that that his tweets do not reflect who he is, they do not reflect who I am or what I believe, I actually think provokes a really good conversation for us to have. And that is, what is my identity? Who am I? And what do I believe? And how do my beliefs inform who I am? And how does who I am inform what I believe? Like, I think those are good conversations for us to be having today. He said, I apologize for the tweets that have come to light from when I was 14 and 15 years old. He tweeted this out on Sunday morning. He says, I used a poor choice of word that does not reflect who I am or what I believe. I did not intend to single out any individual or group. Now, I will tell you that the term that Kyler used is actually a term that has now been broadly adopted by the LGBT community, and that word is queer. And so there was a time when that term was as offensive as what you and I would regard as the N-word, another word we're not going to say, and another word that we're not going to tweet. But that's because we're adults and we understand what we're talking about and we understand the power of platform. Did he understand those things when he was a juvenile, 14 or 15 years old? So this does beg the question, why did he have a Twitter account when he was that young? This is a social media conversation you absolutely want to have with your young people. There is a power of platform that exists related to social media that many young people, and actually, frankly, a lot of fully grown people, do not have the discretion necessary to use those platforms in ways that honor Jesus. And so this is a good opportunity for us to talk about the rules of engagement on social media by Christians. Do I recognize that when I am on whatever platform it is, in this case, Twitter, but do I recognize that when I'm on Facebook or when I'm on Instagram or when I'm on Snap, whatever platform you're on, that you are there as a representative of Jesus Christ, that you are there as an ambassador of the kingdom of heaven, that you are there as a missionary. You're not there to give people a piece of your own mind, and you're certainly not there to affirm the nonsense that others are posting. You're there as an ambassador, as a missionary. And if you view your role and responsibility in that way, does that change what you like, what you follow, what you retweet? I recognize that every retweet is not an endorsement. I get that. But folks who are following you on Twitter, they're reading what you're retweeting. Kyler went on to say the offensive tweets were deleted. He didn't say this. This is what the article says. Sorry. The offensive tweets were deleted late on Saturday night, but screenshots still exist and the conversation back and forth. And he says, I'm not defending the content. I would also say I'm not defending the content of the tweets. What I am suggesting that those who wanted to shame him knew about these tweets before Sunday morning. Those who wanted to shame him knew about these tweets before he was named the Heisman Trophy winner. Those who wanted to shame him picked a point in time. They waited for the biggest night of his life to do it in the most public way possible. Have you ever been to a wedding where they actually ask, does anyone present know any reason why these two people cannot lawfully be wed? I mean, it's pro forma now, because actually if you've been issued a marriage license and it has your name on it, then it doesn't really matter what people might publicly stand up and say, but there's a lot of liturgies that still include this question. If the answer to the question is yes, how Christian is it of you to have waited until the ceremony to stand up and say so? Like, isn't the Matthew model that we go to the individual one-on-one and we expose what we consider to be the error of their ways or the sin, and we see if just by that they wouldn't repent? I feel confident that had those for whom this now 6 or 7 year old tweet feed is a problem, I feel confident they knew about it before this public event where this young man was having the biggest night of his entire life torn apart and publicly shamed for something that he did when he was a teenager. I feel confident somebody could have come to him one-on-one prior to this, and he would have, I feel certain, he would have removed the tweets, and he probably would have made a public apology in advance of the Heisman Trophy presentation evening. He's not alone in what he's experiencing. Comedian Kevin Hart had to step down from hosting Oscars due to tweets from his past. Now, what's different about the Kevin Hart situation is he has actually apologized over and over and over again for these tweets in the past related actually to similar subject matter, similar content to the Kyler Murray tweets. In Hart's case, these revelations were not new, but they were newly used to target him. He has apologized in the past for these particular tweets. He has said that he has grown. He has said that his views have changed. I don't think that way anymore. That's not who I am. That's not what I believe. But the fact that he ever held and expressed such ideas is now considered such high treason that he cannot be allowed the public success of serving as the host of the Oscars. I actually heard one commentator last week on this Kevin Hart story say that not only, in his view, did Kevin Hart need to apologize publicly and profusely, he needed to volunteer for pro-LGBT causes, and he needed to give money, lots of money, this commentator said, to pro-LGBTQ groups. Really? Really? Is that the point at which we've arrived? I have one recommended reading for you today. You guys know that every Monday I put together a must-read Monday list. You can go to reconnectwithcarmen.com, see what I was reading over the weekend and my thoughts about it. Andrew Sullivan penned an essay over the weekend on America's new religions. It appeared in the New York Magazine. In it, he observed, like early modern Christians, they punish heresy by banishing sinners from society and coercing them to public demonstrations of shame, provide an avenue for redemption in the form of a thorough public confession of sin. Sullivan is pointing out here that we have arrived at the place where the mutually agreed upon religion of our society is indeed at this toward this one particular group of people, and those are the LGBTQ advocates. Now, you might be surprised by the secular use of the word sin in relationship to this conversation. But in every single one of these scenarios, what these folks are accused of is sin. Now I want you to think about this. How do you even define sin, publicly or privately, apart from the reality of God? How are we having a moral conversation apart from a moral lawgiver? How are we having a conversation about what is good and what is evil if we don't actually know the one who defines those categories for us? All right, friends, I got to take a quick break. When I come back, my conversation partner is going to be Phil Cook. You know him as a Hollywood producer. He's also been here on Connecting Faith on a prior occasion to talk about his book, Helping Christians Regain Their Credibility in the Marketplace of Ideas, particularly in the area of media. He and I are going to talk today about Christians and the credibility gap. We're also going to talk about media and our engagement in it. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Friends, welcome back to Connecting Faith. I am joined by Phil Cook. I'd love to say we're in studio, but actually we're standing at microphones in a makeshift studio.
On location.
On location in Atlanta. Those of you who recognize Phil's name know him as a producer. Many of you know him also as an author and a church consultant. He has joined us here on Connecting Faith in the past to talk about one of his books, but you got another one out called Unique. I kind of like that one. What? I mean, I like the other one too, but tell people what Unique is. This because we're moving into the time of year and people are thinking about planning for 2019.
It's actually a print planner. You know, in the digital age, everything seems to have gone computerized. But I discovered about a year ago that I can focus more. I can concentrate. You know, apps make it so easy to create to-do lists. And lo and behold, it didn't take long before I had hundreds of to-dos, and I just shut down. They were overwhelming, and many people identify with that. And I discovered that if I can look at that list and pull the top three things I need to do every day, really focus on that. Plus, there's tons of research that indicates when you write stuff down, you remember it much more effectively. So I created a planner that was really designed to help you jumpstart your creativity, help you. It's not too much to fill out. It gives you enough space to be, you know, kind of be free and draw pictures and lists and whatever you need. But it also helps you focus your day on what you actually need to accomplish. It's called Unique, the Ultimate Creative Planner. And it's been fun. People have really jumped on it, so I'm excited.
Yeah, that's really fun. Okay, so you and Jonathan Bock actually came on the show at one point to talk about the book The Way Back. Yeah. Now, I'll admit, I've got listeners who are looking for The Way Back Machine, right, from the movie.
I wouldn't mind finding
but
that.
But we don't have a Way Back Machine, but we do have The Way Back book, How Christians Blew Our Credibility and How We Win It Back. Remind us what the premise of the book is and what people get out of it.
Well, John and I are media and marketing guys. We're communication people, and we live and work in Hollywood. And we've always been frustrated for a very long time on why Christianity seems to be marginalized in the culture. We're losing more and more influence. Everybody knows. I mean, we talked this morning. When I was a kid, prayer in schools, it was perfectly normal. Marriage was between a man and a woman. Abortion was clearly wrong. And in my lifetime, all those things have been turned upside down. And Christians got mad. We got angry about it. And the problem is, I discovered, nobody changes because you get mad at them. And that's not the way to engage the culture. No matter how frustrated we may be, no matter how wrong we may think the direction of the culture is going. So we decided to write a book that we'd gotten to the point where, if you look at the last 30 years, the question is, has the church moved the dial in a positive way on any issue at all? We couldn't find one single issue where we've actually gained ground in the culture and shifted the culture toward Christ. And so we started looking at how we've done it. What's our approach been? And we found out that we need to rethink how we engage, how we communicate with the culture if we're ever going to make a difference.
So cultural engagement. Let's assume that people who are listening are, first of all, Christians.
Yep.
Let's assume that some of them are what we might consider creatives.
Okay.
Actually, let's assume that of a lot of people, right?
Everybody should be.
Right? Everybody is creative in one way or another.
Correct.
And everybody is sort of called as an image bearer of God to bring those creative gifts to bear in the cultivation of the culture towards what I would describe as like righteous fruit. Okay?
Correct.
So
Correct.
How are we going to do that in a digital age?
Well, there's so many tools we have. I mean, Jesus could talk to people. That was about it. He could talk to people, but
if he wanted to talk to a lot of people, he had to stand by a lake and use it as a natural amplifier toward a hill,
You're
right?
You're exactly right.
So what
You're
kind of
exactly
amplifiers
right.
do we have today?
We have all kind of amplifiers. We have social media. We have the digital world. We have video cameras. We have so many ways. In fact, I mean, there are two film festivals now that celebrate films made from iPhones. So don't tell me that you don't have the budget or the equipment to go out and communicate with this culture. You've got a phone in your pocket. You can do some amazing things. And social media, I think people don't realize, and you don't have to be cheesy and corny, but we all have this remarkable social media tool, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. We can reach out to people and share the gospel, but we need to do it in a very authentic, personal, real way. Not try to preach all the time, not try to lecture all the time. Try to engage. The whole thing about social media is being social, and we forget that sometimes.
So, Phil, all of our listeners in Wisconsin, we're not telling you not to be cheesy, and all of our listeners we're not telling you not to be corny. So it's fine for corn and cheese in those two places. Okay.
Yeah, but just those two.
So you have a great video. Let me just tell people, philcook.com is a great portal to like everything that you're doing. Your YouTube channel, you've got a video right now about the power of what you're calling a short film. Now, short means like 3 to 6 minutes.
Correct.
Tell everybody that's listening what they ought to be doing in a 3 to 6 minute film to reach other people.
Tell me a compelling story. You know, if you have facts, I get a lot of ministries and nonprofit organizations and churches who will send me short videos, and they're filled with facts, statistics, you know, how many people they led to Christ or how many homeless people they took in or how many meals they served. All that's fantastic. But put that on the website. Put it in a brochure. A video is about an emotionally compelling story. I want to hear the story of someone's life that was transformed because of the gospel, because of your service, because of something you've done to engage with that person. That's what makes a compelling video. It's not about facts. It's about or statistics or numbers. It's really about an emotional story of life change. That's what really gets people to watch and then want to share it with other people.
And then that's the power of sort of the multiplier effect of social media, because if I post an impact video that's 3 minutes and, you know, I might only have a few followers, but if those few followers share it with their followers, then so on and so on and so on.
It can be unbelievable. In fact, you and I were speaking to a group here in Atlanta this morning, and I mentioned that the largest country, the most populated country on the planet right now is Facebook. We don't think in terms like that, but the truth is churches should be sending missionaries to that country. They should be planting churches in that country. How can we engage? Missions isn't just about geographical boundaries. It's about digital boundaries. How do we reach that country with the gospel? And trust me, we can do it.
So we've had Craig Detweiler here on the program a couple of times. I know you know Craig.
Very well.
We also had some guy on. I'm going to have to dig this out. Because when you said that earlier about being a missionary to those kinds of things, he's like a missionary to like the gaming world. And he is like an intentional Minecraft missionary. Like the Minecraft
awesome.
Worlds is where he is engaging for the gospel. How cool is that?
I think it's amazing. And I would put that as a challenge to people. You may be a gamer. Fine. Use that world to share the gospel. You may be a social media person. Great. Use that world to share the gospel. We should be. One of the great frustrations for me is that Christians just don't casually share their faith with other people. I mean, you think that we're losing so much ground in the culture. We're being marginalized. People don't even pay attention to us anymore. But there are millions of Christians out there. If we just, each one of us, just say once a month, just casually brought up the gospel with a waitress, with somebody at a hotel, with somebody next to you on an airplane, somebody at the office, we could have a remarkable, remarkable impact out there. It's not that
Friends,
hard.
My conversation partner is Phil Cook. You can find him at Phil Cook, that ends with an E, philcooke.com. I should say, what does the E stand for?
No, that's
for?
Good. You know what?
You're
I'm
like Phil Cookie.
I'm embarrassed to say my dad added it.
Really?
Yeah, after he was an adult, he thought cook without the E looked funny, and so he actually added the E. So I don't know if I'm legal or not, but I think.
So, Phil, names matter. Since that's a good segue to the names matter conversation,
sure.
I know that you are a firm believer that we ought to be interested in having the names of our organizations and even our churches be meaningful and winsome to people in the culture. Tell us the story of the school in Michigan.
Sure. That, you know, we live in the most distracted culture in the history of the world, which means sometimes names are all you have. People will give you the name, and if they don't like it, they'll move on. And there was a college in Michigan, Grand Rapids Baptist Bible College. Very successful school, great school reputation, been around for 100 years. Years ago, they decided to drop Baptist, so it became Grand Rapids Bible College. Well, about 20 or 25 years ago, they decided they'd take an even bigger step. And it went from, they went, now keep in mind, they didn't change anything else. They didn't change the faculty or the subjects or the facility. All they did was change the name. And they went from Grand Rapids Bible College to Cornerstone University. Guess what? In 1 year, enrollment doubled. Doubled. And all they did was change the name. I mean, who wants to go to Grand Rapids Bible College? But apparently, Cornerstone University sounds pretty exciting. And it's a great example of the power of an effective name. In this world that's so distracted, that we're being pulled in so many directions, just the name today means more than ever. And it could be your church name, it could be your company name, it could be your outreach, your program, your book, whatever. Names matter more than ever.
So what does the name of Jesus mean to you, and why does it matter?
It's interesting. That's an interesting conversation, because names also take on what we call brand equity. You know, brand equity is something that it's the integrity and the equity that a name builds up over time. Billy Graham is a good example. Billy Graham has such a powerful name. Even if the Billy Graham ministry would make a mistake or do something stupid, people are likely to forgive them because the integrity and the value of that name. And Jesus is the same exact way. I think that when we look at a name like that, trust is so incredibly important. So the question I would ask is, do people trust your church? Do they trust you? Do they trust your outreach? Do they trust what you're trying to do? And does your name help convey that sense of trust?
I think there's sometimes that we are challenging people to trust Jesus when we're not being very trustworthy.
Oh,
where we're trying to say the name of Jesus is credible, and they're looking at the church and they're saying, I'm not seeing that in the people who claim his name. So in terms of the credibility gap, let's just return to that.
Sure.
And let's call people to a credible witness.
Absolutely. It's incredibly important. Sadly, one of the things I get called into, because, you know, our team is a media team, when a church fails, when they have a moral failure or a team member suddenly, you know, makes some terrible, terrible mistake and there's a crisis, we get called in to help them navigate that. How do we tell the congregation? Do we tell the press? Do we issue a public statement? Those kind of things. So sadly, over the last 5, 6, 7 years, I've seen some horrible, horrible things. And there's a reason that that the secular world marginalizes Christianity, and a big part of it is we have no credibility. So many of us have made mistakes. And in the truth, we're all fallen, and we're all, you know, under God's grace. However, there are so many areas where we need to work to intentionally build trust and build integrity, because that makes a huge impact on people.
Hey, friends, if you want to reach out to Phil Cook, you can do so at philcook.com. Those of you who remember the conversation that we had here on Connecting Faith with Nick Ripken in relationship to the insanity of God, that is actually a film that Phil produced.
Yeah.
And so we thank you for that and your love for our persecuted brothers and sisters around the world. All right, I got to take another quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking religious liberty. Phil Cook, thank you so much for being with us today on Connecting Faith. Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge, joined this afternoon in conversation by Whit Briskey. His actual formal name is Whitman Briskey, but he goes by Whit. He is an entrepreneurial lawyer with 35 years experience representing small businesses, professionals, and religious organizations. He is with our friends at Mock and Baker in Chicago, and they graciously come on to talk with us periodically about religious liberty and civil rights issues here in the United States. They also have a really cool podcast called Lawyers for Jesus. Whit, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, good to talk to you, Carmen.
It's great to talk with you too. So let's do this. Let's look back over 2018 and just tell us what stands out in your mind.
Well, I think the biggest standout, of course, was the masterpiece cake decision. which was a 7-2 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court, that the baker in Masterpiece Cake did not have to bake a cake which had a message favorable to a gay wedding, and didn't have to bake for a gay wedding. Now, the baker would bake for homosexuals for birthday parties and everything, but said, I can't do it for your wedding. And the Supreme Court, though, it seems like 7-2 is a great decision, but it was really a lot narrower in terms of how the decision was written. So this issue is going to come back probably a lot of times. There are cases winding their way through for florists who have been asked to provide flowers at gay weddings, for musicians, for people who make movies of these various creative type persons associated with weddings. And so this issue is not going to go away.
So, Whit, I know that there are some things on the radar of the Supreme Court now. You sent me an email that I haven't even fully had time to read about something the Supreme Court did today. So I'm going to let you share that breaking news with everybody.
Well, yeah. After it became known that Planned Parenthood was selling the body parts of aborted fetuses, aborted children, a lot of states said, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to provide Medicaid funds to Planned Parenthood. We want to cut them off because this is such a horrible thing that they are doing. So a couple of states, including Kansas, have attempted to do that, and several possible patients of Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit against them. They won in the lower court and in the Court of Appeals, and just today in a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court decided not to take the case. Now, the issue that they had before them was not whether Planned Parenthood can do abortions or sell body parts. The only issue that was before the court was whether individual patients would have a private right of action to sue those states. So it was a relatively, again, a narrow opinion, but it's something that I'm sure will disappoint a lot of people who were hoping that we could somehow put some pressure on Planned Parenthood.
Friends, we're talking with Whit Brisky. He is with the law firm Mock and Baker in Chicago. He spends a lot of time working in the area of religious liberty, and so he's here giving us a bit of a review of 2018, and now he and I are going to look ahead to 2019. Whit, what do you feel like is on the radar in terms of religious liberty, either for individuals or for organizations in the coming year?
Well, there are a couple of cases before the U.S. Supreme Court on, in effect, public displays of Christianity. So there are several monument cases where atheists or others have objected to crosses in public places, whether in cemeteries or on public land anywhere, really, in front of courthouses. And the Supreme Court's jurisprudence on this has been very confused over the years, and so it is hoped, at least, that the Supreme Court will straighten out the law and make it clear, although given their history, it's unlikely to actually clear things up totally. But that's one kind of case that there are a lot of. And then there's the case of the coach who, after the game was over, and a public school coach, went out in the middle of the playing field and kneeled down and prayed, and sometimes students would come around and gather around him and pray with him. And he was told by his employer, the school district, no, you can't do that. You can't pray when there are any students around. And, of course, he couldn't accept that, so he was fired. And so that case is making its way up to the Supreme Court and likely will be decided this year. There are several other things that are kind of winding their way up. There are the most recent tax law may have imposed taxation on certain kinds of benefits which are given to employees of churches, parking benefits and other things. But I think,
now, I will just admit to you, Whit, that when I think about this conversation about the parking, and I think that right now I'm parked at a church, right? And I realize I'm not an employee here. But the pastor who parked next to me, that's considered a benefit? Like, is that,
well,
that's, is that essentially what we're saying? Or is it some other kind of parking situation?
Well, that's what some people are claiming, that it's, you know, if the church has a parking lot and employees are allowed to park at the parking lot, they should be taxed on that. But I don't really think that's what's happening. I think what they're talking about is if the church were, say, in a public, or in a large city, in the inner city, like in Chicago, and you had to park at a public parking lot because there was no church parking lot, for which there was a payment, and the church reimbursed you, maybe that would be taxable. So I think it's probably not going to be as big a concern as some people are saying, but the IRS hasn't come out with final rules yet, and so I may be surprised when that happens.
Well, that kind of gets us to the clergy housing allowance conversation. Do you have any update on, I mean, I know that that feels like that's something that we return to over and over again. Where are we at on that?
Well, the lower court in Milwaukee decided that there should be no housing allowance, that was discrimination against or in favor of a religion and therefore establishment. And that case was argued before the Seventh Circuit about 2 weeks ago, and they have not yet ruled. But we can expect that case will be decided sometime in the next 6 months or so, and we'll get an opinion, and it's likely that will, at least they will try to appeal it to the U.S. Supreme Court. So that could be a 2020 decision by the Supreme Court. And that could be very expensive for churches or for pastors, whoever is going to take the economic hit, because, you know, if you've got a mortgage payment of $1,500 a month, and all of that is taxable rather than deductible or excludable, that's going to be a big hit on the tax payment of those clergy and maybe on the churches who are going to have to make up the difference.
All right, friends, my conversation partner is Whit Briskey. He's with Mauck & Baker, which is a law firm based in Chicago, Illinois. Now, one of the cool things that you guys have on your website is called the Church Legal Checklist. And instead of telling people, you know, how to spell Mauck, which has a U in it, and that's just weird, I'm just going to tell them to Google Church Legal Checklist, because when you Google Church Legal Checklist, it takes you to the website where the Church Legal Checklist is. Tell us what is a Church Legal Checklist and why should every church use it?
We tried as a firm, because we represent so many small churches who may not have 20 or 30 lawyers in their congregation, to help them comply with the law and reduce the risk to these congregations. So we put together this checklist that the church board can review over a year or a year and a half, take up one section of it for each meeting, and it'll go through things like bylaws and insurance and child protection and church discipline and a lot of these things which implicate the law in one way or another, and allow the board to, if possible, solve their own problems, and if they can't solve their own problems, to be able to call a good lawyer or a good insurance representative or a good accountant in order to do those things. So you can get this church checklist, go through it, it's free, and try to protect your church from all of these wolves that are out there.
Okay, so I just got to tell you, Whit, people are not used to getting anything free from a lawyer. So So I think that should be what we highlight. So you guys, this is, if you're listening right now, this is actually a free church legal self-audit guide, and you can find it at Mauck Baker, M-A-U-C-K-B-A-K-E-R, mauckbaker.com/church-legal, or you can just Google church legal checklist. This is what will come up. It's free. It's downloadable. And it's a wonderful opportunity for you to engage in a conversation with your session, with your board of deacons, with the folks who have responsibility for the life and ministry of your church, this is a great opportunity for you to know that you're asking the right questions, you're having the right conversations, in order that you can then go get the right kinds of coverage or people to help you or put the right kinds of policies in place. I'm just saying that if you're not already doing this, please take advantage of this free downloadable guide that Mauch and Baker has developed.
Well,
hey, Whit. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So I'm just curious, like, what's on your, when you look at sort of the docket in front of you, what do you find the most interesting?
Oh, well, practicing law is a lot of fun. I get to do constitutional cases. And there are very few lawyers who actually get to do that. And right now I'm working on a lot of free speech cases, which also impact religious freedom, because the idea is to really stamp out conservative and Christian ideas. They don't want them spoken in the public square. And so that's one of the things which really gets my motor going. And we're suing the state of Illinois, actually the University of Illinois, right now on free speech issues, where they've tried to squelch the work of some student journalists. So these are the kinds of things which really get me going in the morning, although there's plenty of work for me to do.
So I'm curious, Whit, in terms of we have a major transition coming in the House of Representatives in Congress. I know that one of the expectations that we have of a Democrat-controlled House is the Equality Act. What if anything, do you know about that?
Well, unlike many state laws, the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which is against discrimination in employment, only talks about sex discrimination. And so over the years, the courts have held that that means discrimination against men or discrimination against women, and has nothing to do with either transgender or homosexual discrimination. And in Congress, they've attempted to amend this several times and have failed. So now they're going to try to do this again, which is what the proposed Equality Act does. But I think while it's highly likely that it will pass the House, because the Democrats are pretty much all in line behind it, it is very unlikely that it would be able to pass the Senate. So at least at the moment, I don't think that's the greatest challenge. The greater challenge is that the Supreme Court might on its own, and there are cases up right now in the Supreme Court which would interpret sex discrimination to include discrimination against LGBT groups. So that I think that's the greater danger.
Friends, my conversation partner is Whit Briskey. You can check out all of this and more at mauchbaker.com. You can certainly check out their Lawyers for Jesus radio program and podcast. Whit, thank you so much for being with us here today. We're going to encourage people to go check out the church legal checklist at the end of the year as we move into a new year as well.
Thank you, Carmen. I really enjoyed being on.
Well, likewise. Thanks so much. All right, friends, I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'll be making the connecting point. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. To Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. It is time for us to make the connecting point. So I thought it might be interesting today to talk about this situation as a teacher, a French teacher, at a school called West Point High School, Peter Vlaming. And Peter Vlaming refused to Oh, that's probably not the right word. Resisted administrators' orders, I think, is the language here, to use male pronouns to refer to a ninth grade student who is biologically female, who presents as male. And so the reason that we're talking about Peter Vlaming today, this French teacher at West Point High School, is that after a four-hour hearing, the school board voted 5-0 to fire him. To terminate Mr. Vlaming for failing to do what they required, which was to use pronouns that are not consistent with the biology of the student with whom he is, about whom this entire case revolves. So the board met in closed session for nearly an hour before the vote, and Mr. Vlaming, who, by the way, is only 47 years old, it's not like we're talking about an old guy here. He's taught at the school for nearly 7 years after spending more than a decade in France preparing to teach French. And he told his superiors, he told both the principal of the school and eventually the school board, that his Christian faith prevented him from using male pronouns for a student who is female. Now, Mr. Vlaming is a father of four, and he has met with concerned parents, and he said that he would use the student's name and attempt to avoid offensive pronouns. However, here's basically what happened. The student was apparently wearing virtual reality goggles and was at risk of literally running into a wall when Mr. Vlaming intervened and, in what is described as a moment of panic, used the wrong pronoun in an effort to keep the student from hitting the wall. And for that, he was fired. Now, friends, this is not some hypothetical, this might happen scenario. This is something that has happened in the United States of America. This is a real conversation about real people in a real school in America today. And so what is a Christian who is also an employee supposed to do? This is a good question. What is a Christian to do in any environment where there is cultural pressure to do something that, in the view of the Christian worldview, is not consistent with reality? Well, I would say that each and every one of us who is on social media needs to be engaged in thinking through. We got to be thinking about what we're thinking about here. We got to be thinking through these issues and concerns, because actually Facebook and Twitter already have in the fine print requirements that you and I, if we are going to use their platforms, that we would use pronouns that are consistent with a person's current gender identity or sexual orientation expression, which can change, which can be different day to day for some people. And so the challenge is going to be keeping up with who wants to be referred to as what, in what environment, and on what day. And oh, by the way, calling someone by the name that they have had and the name that you have known them for is now, if they have now adopted a new name, you cannot call them by their old name. So if Prince doesn't want to be Prince, he wants to be the artist formerly known as Prince, or he wanted to be called something else, then you cannot dead name him by calling him Prince. The same would be true if we are going to talk about the person who currently identifies as Caitlyn Jenner. You are not allowed to call that person by the name under which that individual, you can see my attempt here to avoid all pronouns, won gold medals or appeared on a Wheaties box. I don't know. Does Wheaties have to go back now and change those iconic images? I don't know. Maybe they do. Terms of service is what I want to spend a couple of minutes talking about here today, because I will admit to you that I do not always read the fine print in the terms of service, particularly on social media platforms, because they're very long. I confess that I have on occasion agreed to terms of service that I have, in fact, not fully read. So let me ask you, have you read the terms of service for every social media platform on which you are engaged? If not, let me just say the time has arrived that we must do so. We give up a ton of personal information in this particular arena of social media, And I think that there are times that we give up a lot of security for convenience and perceived influence, and maybe it's time for us to evaluate all of that. I was convicted recently when someone I respect closed all their social media accounts as a witness to their kids. They wanted to bear witness to their kids that it's actually possible to cultivate an identity in a world free from contrived or filtered fear of missing out digital pictures. And so that led me to seriously consider why I'm on social media and to what end. So as a part of my consideration, I actually started reading more of the fine print. And that's when I received a notification that Twitter was updating its terms of service. So instead of just instinctively clicking agree, which I confess I might have done in the past, instead I read them. Twitter has updated one section of its terms of service that is absolutely related to the conversation that we just had about Peter Vlaming and the loss of his job for a failure to use what one student and therefore the school district views as the proper pronoun, even though it is the pronoun contrary to reality. Twitter updated its hateful conduct policy. It's worth reading the entire hateful conduct policy in the terms of service on Twitter. The entire page is worth reading. So you can get a sense of things that people now need to be told about how to relate to other people. I highlighted as I was reading it several things that I suspect Twitter will need to further clarify as the cultural conversation continues to devolve. But let's look at one particular restriction. It's a restriction against, quote, repeated and or non-consensual slurs, epithets, racist and sexist tropes, or other content that degrades someone. Now, you and I might be able to discern what that means. Twitter thinks we need further clarification. So they have offered this, quote, we prohibit targeting individuals with repeated slurs, tropes, or other content that intends to dehumanize, degrade, or reinforce negative or harmful stereotypes about a protected category. And you would say, that makes total sense. Those of us who recognize the dignity of every human being, we don't want to see anybody dehumanized or degraded. We don't want to reinforce negative or harmful stereotypes about protected categories. Twitter goes on, being sure that we have gotten the point. This includes targeted misgendering or dead naming of transgender individuals. Huh. Dehumanization suggests that we all share a common understanding of what it means to be human. That is a great worldview conversation. But it's that last sentence, this includes targeted misgendering or dead naming of transgender individuals, that ought to catch our attention today. If you refer to an individual with pronouns associated with his or her genetically biological gender, but that individual identifies with some other gender, you will be guilty on Twitter of misgendering that person. Now, what differentiates that from targeted misgendering? I have no idea. That apparently lies within the discretion of Twitter to determine our motivation, now, and then to ban the user based on their sole discretionary judgment. You might be asking yourself, and what is dead naming? Well, dead naming is calling the person who identifies as Caitlyn Jenner, Bruce. If we persist in referring to that person by their given name instead of the name by which they now decide they want to be called, then we are, quote, dead naming. Ignorance is no longer an excuse, by the way. Okay, so there's a lot of commentary right now online about this. I have posted an article for you at reconnectwithcarmen.com entitled Terms of Service. If you want to know more. Friends, that's about all the time we've got today here on Connecting Faith. I would encourage you to visit the website, myfaithradio.com. Visit the Connecting Faith page. We've always got new stuff posted for you there. We've got new stuff posted for you as well at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I look forward to seeing you back here actually on Friday, because the next 3 days we'll be engaged in our winter share campaign here on Faith Radio. This is a great time to give. Have a great day, and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of connecting faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.